My name's Will DeFries, and this is the Sunday Scaries Podcast, your cure for the Sunday blues. This week, we're going to discuss the most amateur drinking holidays, quarantine-approved shows to binge-watch, and a Sunday conversation with Tyler Nauman, the general manager of Eberly in Austin, Texas. Is it so wrong for me to enjoy the solitude of a bar that's not spilling over with people I don't and never want to know? Am I a bad person for wanting to slide a couple quarters in the jukebox and listen to Bob Seger's Live Bullet while holding a conversation that doesn't require yelling? Is it crazy to think that you don't need an excuse to get absolutely hammered other than you don't have any responsibilities that day other than, well, just getting hammered? The answer is a firm no on all three accounts, and I'll stand by that, especially with everyone quarantining themselves for the foreseeable future. But seemingly once every month, everyone decides to come out and play. In flocks, bargoers creep out of their apartments and fill the streets. They stand in lines, raise the prices, and get as drunk as humanly possible simply because society deems one day on the calendar to be more important than the others. Those days, few and far between, are some of my least favorite days of the year because I not only hate strangers, but I hate loud, drunk, and obnoxious strangers even more. These are the most amateur drinking holidays. Number 5. Cinco de Mayo. Great, an excuse for everyone to go get blackout drunk on one liquor they swore off after college. While I'm as much of a fan of tacos and margaritas as much as anyone, I'm not a fan of large wait times and shoulder-to-shoulder seating. Every single Cinco de Mayo, you find yourself doing exactly what everyone else is trying to do, going to a Mexican or Tex-Mex restaurant that you can get the real experience at. But because it's widely accepted as the Latin version of St. Patrick's Day, you and every other person in town is waiting in the same line to go to the same restaurant to drink the same margaritas served to you by the same waiter who hates his life. Number 4, the night before Thanksgiving. As an avid fan of getting the band back together while blasting The Boys Are Back in Town en route to your local hometown watering hole, the night before Thanksgiving is widely considered to be the biggest bar night of the year. Thanksgiving is the perfect day for a hangover. Football, food to soak up the booze from the night before, and all the excuses in the world to keep drinking throughout the day to delay the hangover until Friday. But with the biggest bar night of the year, you get people from all walks of life. The excitement of being home from school or their dead-end big city jobs getting the best of everyone, they all end up drunkenly talking to the girl they had a crush on in high school only to throw up on the sheets of their childhood bedroom. The bars are packed, the cops are out in full force, and you're probably coughing up a cover charge for a bar that never charges cover. Oh, and the girl from high school you had a crush on? Yeah, she's still not going to hook up with you. Number 3, Halloween. The childhood tradition of going door-to-door asking for candy turned into an adulthood tradition of hopping bar-to-bar taking shots you don't want to take. Whether it's the costumes, the cold weather, or a combination of both, Halloween, which is a largely pointless holiday, forces everyone to dress up like a dumbass and hit the town with a full head of steam. Myself, I'm not really a costume guy, but I'm not going to knock those who are. But the last thing I want to encounter when I'm trying to order a shot and a beer is getting hit in the face with some oversized angel wings while a drunk girl asks me what my shitty costume is with slurred speech. Any holiday that forces people to dress up, whether it's classy or in a costume, is destined to 1. Elevate standards, and 2. Never meet those elevated standards. Tears will be cried through the makeup and face paint, and most couples will argue incessantly on their Uber ride home. Number 2. New Year's Eve. The classier side of Halloween, where you're expected to dress like you have more money than you actually do while drinking enough champagne that you feel like your throat is going to bust out of the back of your neck. The same rules apply for New Year's Eve as they do for Halloween. Everyone's high expectations are going to force them into thinking it's going to be the best night ever, only to watch the night fall flat and feel deflated for dressing up all for naught. Even worse is that you find yourself buying a 3-figure ticket for a club or hotel bar where you're guaranteed a champagne toast, which is just cooks, and a buffet where you can enjoy the cold food and risk of food poisoning. Little do they tell you, you're going to be standing around a bunch of other people you don't know trying to get to the bar while they serve you a $12 bullet can of Bud Light while some dude in a tuxedo bumps into you as he chants for the DJ to play Closer by the Chainsmokers again. Not a great scene. And number 1, St. Patrick's Day. The amateur drinking holiday. The day when everyone claims to have more Irish heritage than they actually have. The day where the bars dye Miller Light and your puke green. The day where everyone flocks to the nearest major city to get as drunk as possible, as early as possible, surrounded by as many people as possible. Sure, I don't look great in green, but that's not the real reason why I avoid this holiday at all costs. Something about the faux Irish American just screams, I'm going to get in a fight with someone, and that's just not me. The last thing I want to do on a Saturday afternoon is encounter some dude with green stained lips trying to fight me because he almost threw up on my back while I sit at the bar and he tried to order Irish car bombs, a drink that no actual Irishman would actually order. On St. Patrick's Day, Everyone's a Flogging Molly and Dropkick Murphys fan, and everyone goes to the greatest length possible to show just how proud they are to wear green and pose for photos in front of that gross river in Chicago. Take your drunken lullabies elsewhere, Patrick. I've got some Bob Seger to listen to. Yes, we are in the midst of a pandemic, something unlike any of us have ever encountered before, and something we can all agree we'd never like to encounter again. While I'm not at the self-quarantine level yet, I'm inching closer and closer every single day as the news cycle slowly breaks me down. Despite the fact that quarantine life in my apartment isn't that much different than the life I live day in and day out, my mind takes me back to 2009 when I was one of the unfortunate people to contract another infection we've all heard of, swine flu. How did I handle it? Well, not all that well. Between the fever and the throw up and the loss of 14 pounds over the span of a week, it was one of the worst 2 week periods of my life. My only saving grace, I binge watched the entire series Greek, which was then on ABC Family. Was I proud of this? No, absolutely not. Will I ever watch Greek again? Again, it's not happening. But is mindless television the absolute best way to kill some time when you're stuck in your apartment with no sports for the foreseeable future? Oh yeah. Here are a few Sunday Scaries quarantine approved suggestions. The first, Love Island Australia on Hulu. It was a sad day in our apartment complex when we only had one episode left of season one. After watching nearly 30 episodes, we had bonded with these trashy Aussies for more than we ever thought we could. The premise of the show is quite simple. Hot Australians get sent to Mallorca, Spain, where they couple up with each other and date over the course of 6 weeks. At the end of those 6 weeks, Australia votes on the winning couple who gets $50,000 and eternal love. At least that is until they break up with each other the second taping is over. While there's an American and British version also out, we found the Americans to be too boring and the Brits to be a little too trashy. So while the show is peak trashy TV, even in Australia, you do somewhat feel like you're on vacation with them in their spotless villa while house music plays all the time. And with season 2 becoming available on Hulu just this past week, it's the gift that keeps on giving. Next, we have Sex Education on Netflix. There are 2 seasons of it, which makes it perfect for quarantining. I was hesitant to even start it. High schoolers in Wales having sex with one another while the main character gives them sex advice that he stole from his therapist's mother, it sounds just a bit dramatic. But as I got about 10 minutes into the first episode, I soon realized this show is different for all the right reasons. Whether it's the picturesque Welsh setting of the show, the fresh banter, the blunt locker room humor, it's a show that you want to keep watching even when it's past your bedtime. While season 1 is a riot, season 2 starts to hit you in the feels a little bit. Don't pretend I didn't warn you. And finally, we have The Morning Show on Apple TV+. This is a show that's been nominated for Golden Globe and SAG Awards, but a show I feel like nobody has seen. While it's not as brainless as the other 2 shows, the show starring Jennifer Aniston, Steve Carell, and Reese Witherspoon does have a flair for the dramatic. But when I ask people at group dinners if they've seen it yet, it's just kind of crickets. Whether it's because it's on Apple TV+, or because it might just not have that much firepower, it legitimately feels like no one has actually watched this show. The premise is pretty much exactly what happened with Matt Lauer on the Today Show, so it'll take your mind off COVID-19 and direct it back to what was all over the news cycle before, the Me Too era. The best part? If you don't have Apple TV and you don't want to pay for it, fear not. If you've purchased pretty much any Apple product over the last year or so, you get a year of the streaming service for free. And when we've got this much time on our hands, we all need to take all the free stuff we can get. Before we get into this week's Sunday conversation, let's hear from this week's presenting sponsor, Bespoke Post. This winter, start a new routine to upgrade your everyday life with a monthly box of awesome from Bespoke Post. Bespoke Post sends guys only the best stuff every month. So whether you're looking to commemorate an occasion with a champagne saber or toast perfectly aged winter cocktails, Box of Awesome has you covered. From styling grooming goods to barware to cooking tools and outdoor gear, Box of Awesome has carefully built collections for every part of your life. Over the last few months alone, I've gotten numerous boxes that I can't stop using around my apartment. A cocktail shaker that's up my martini intake, new steak knives that look and feel like the most expensive things I own, and more. To get started, take a quiz at boxofawesome.com. Your answers will help them pick the right box of awesome for you. They release new boxes every month across a ton of different categories. It's free to sign up, and you can skip a month or cancel anytime. And the best part, each box costs only $45 and has over $70 worth of gear inside. Get 20% off your first monthly box when you sign up at boxofawesome.com and enter promo code SCARIES at checkout. That's boxofawesome.com, code SCARIES for 20% off your first box. Tyler Nauman is the general manager of Eberle, a popular restaurant in Austin, Texas. I had the unique opportunity to sit down with Tyler this past week to discuss everything from how Eberle became the restaurant it is today, design tips for people with little design prowess, and how COVID-19's cancellation of South by Southwest in Austin is going to affect the city as a whole. And while COVID-19 hadn't reached the heights it's reached the days following the interview, I can say that many of Tyler's sentiments hold true even now that it's more widespread. Enjoy. Tyler, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So for those not familiar with the restaurant space, what does a general manager of a restaurant actually do? What does it encompass as a whole?
It's a little bit of everything, but it's normally got a little bit more finance in it. For me, I always have a joke that the GM stands for general maintenance man, which means I'm there to kind of maintain everything, whether it's the facility or the guest experience or the staff morale, payroll, or the building completely falling apart. Those are kind of all things within my realm of work.
Yeah. So you're the general manager of Eberle.
Yes, sir.
I'd say very popular restaurant on South Lamar in Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
I've been to it numerous times. I've been there before I knew I was having you on.
Yeah.
It's a hot spot. Yes. It's been described as a hotel without rooms. For anyone who hasn't been to Austin yet, describe what the goal in designing Eberle was.
So everyone always asks me who designed Eberle or who built the place. And I never like to say it was specifically one person because it just took so many influences from so many different places, though Mickey Spencer is going to be our primary designer. The hotel without the rooms example is probably my example that I use the most, just more for a couple reasons that we have spaces that are used in a lot of different ways. How the restaurant is laid out and our physical footprint is about 14,000 square feet.
It's a huge space.
Which is insane. It's definitely like, you know, it's not necessarily something an independent restaurant would go for as a first swing at something. So we have like the main dining room side, which would be more the formal dining room experience. It's a little bit quieter. It's booked reservations on through OpenTable. Then we have our old historic Cedar Tavern Bar, which is more of like our lobby bar. It's a first come first serve space, more lower seating and higher seating. We have a hidden room in the back, which makes it fun, called the Canna Room. And then we have an upstairs space, which we use kind of like a convention space.
Okay. Tell me about the bar. I know that there's a long backstory to it.
Bar, yes.
The process that it took to put the entire thing together, any entertaining stories about the bar?
Yeah, so that is kind of what we call the crown jewel of the property. It is called the Cedar Tavern Bar, and it's always been called the Cedar Tavern Bar because it used to be on Cedar Street in New York. It's an old artist bar. Jackson Pollock, Andy Warhol, Bob Dylan, Jack Kerouac, Dennis Hopper, they all used to kind of hang out at that bar. My best way of kind of putting it in time frame is that if you've ever seen the movie Gangs of New York, Leonardo DiCaprio, when that movie was being time framed, that bar was actually in the Five Points District in New York in the gang area pouring drinks. So it's seen some shit, I guess you could say. Our owners have a personal relationship, I guess you could say, with that bar when they went to college at NYU. Fast forward a couple years later or a couple centuries later, they got the opportunity to purchase the bar, and then I always say this even in my story, and excuse my language, but it always kind of lived in a shithole.
Mm-hmm.
It never really was in a nice place. One of my favorite stories is Jackson Pollock got thrown out of the Cedar Tavern for throwing a door at someone.
How do you even throw a door at somebody?
He pulled it off, man. Literally and figuratively, I guess. but we didn't get it in very good conditions. Basically hired a company that specializes in moving high-end pianos. They broke it down in like 600-700 pieces. They put it on a truck, moved to Austin, and then it sat in storage for about 10 years until we put it together. And the original idea of Eberle was not Eberle, it was the Cedar Tavern Bar.
Yeah.
And that's of the other ideas that we want to tell the story of Angelina Eberle. But our owner's original intentions were to find a shotgun bar downtown that they could rip the bar out, put the Cedar Tavern in, and just let it live its life. They were looking for a floor with a dirt bar. They were looking for a floor that was dirt downtown for this bar to live. Then they found the property that it lives at now, and the story just kind of kept evolving and evolving and evolving and to where we are now.
Tell me about the secret room.
Yes.
The secret bar? Is it a secret? Like, how do you even get in there?
It's a little bit of everything. So I think it's really important for us to know, or everyone to know, is like what we originally set out to do with Eberle to where we are now is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
We were kind of defined by our clientele. We were originally supposed to not be as busy as we were, and then utilize the spaces much differently than we do now. We've changed because our clientele has kind of evolved on what we want to do. We probably serve probably 2,500 people come through a week between at night and then our brunch service on the weekends. And then we have this, what we call the cannon room, because our logo is a cannon. And it's the idea is that you can be really, really loud back there and really no one knows what's going on. It's our private event space. It's just, it's got its own bar, its own access point from the kitchen, its own restroom, its own table. Our owners, they always like to use collection of adjectives to describe spaces. And they originally were like, we wanted to feel like a secret club kind of opium den thing. Like minimal lights, low seats, thick fabrics, marbles, excessive textures, and then antiques. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how we built the space.
Well, so the entire space, I don't want to say it's eclectic, because I feel like sometimes saying eclectic means that it's like a mess, but it's eclectic in the sense that there's just, you can tell that there's a lot of thought that goes into the various things that are in the restaurant.
Yeah. So we have six different spaces, and each one of them, it's really weird. Cause if you're to like go online and look up this restaurant and then look at all the photos, just in Google Photos, it doesn't make very much sense. Mm-hmm. Just because all the spaces definitely have their own identity. They have their own set of textures. They have their own set of materials. They have different heights. They have different elements that make them truly unique. And if you look at them just from a photo perspective, it doesn't really all come together. You think they're different places. And that's, again, with the hotel thing. It's like where you can go to different places in a hotel. And you know, they're all part of the same brand under the same roof with the same air conditioning units. They just look different. And Everly is definitely got that going. But until you're in this space and you can look around and you can kind of understand the intentions, that's where everything kind of comes together.
Yeah.
On paper, if you were to write everything down, and like they actually did that with me. They had everything written down, like, boom, what do you think about that? And I was just like, that's a bad idea. I don't think any of that's going to work. And then I got in the space and I kind of understood it from more of an emotional perspective. And it was very a romantic thing, I guess you could say.
What kind of process, a continuing process, goes into keeping the restaurant fresh? I mean, when you walk in there, you can see that there's a lot of effort that goes into it, and it's not just like a set it and forget it kind of situation.
Flexibility in a restaurant is super important. I think that if you're going to have like be set in stone, like this is exactly how we're going to do it, you got to listen to your guests. Mm-hmm. If they like something or they don't like something, like those are just as important. And that's people just naturally assume that's going to be like something you eat or something you drink. It's about kind of how you feel. It's going to be about if it's too cold or too warm, or it's too bright or it's too dark, whether the floor can get sticky easy or certain places can't be dimmed or there's too much this or too much that. And for me, normally in a restaurant world, how people say keep it fresh is consistent marketing and consistent basically staying up with technology, like the idea of the favors and the Uber Eats and stuff like that. Like that's how most restaurants are embracing themselves, and that's kind of what the client wants. And we don't do any of that.
Yeah.
So for us, we have to, stay planted and rooted in what we originally set out to do with the idea that we want to be a member of the community. And then vice versa, we have to be able to listen to our staff and listen to our guests on what's working and what's not working and making sure that we're accommodating, making sure that we're paying attention. I think that pulse is super important. Mm-hmm.
So just the look of Everly it's very noticeable. It's very good looking. A lot of the questions that I get from our listeners are kind of people asking like, what do I do to make my apartment look better? What do I do to, you know, upgrade this? Totally. Do you have any general style rules or design tips that you would offer to people who are maybe trying to, you know, upgrade their own situation?
For me, I went to school for design. I always say have a color palette that's no more than four tones and two variants. And then for me, have consistent textures. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's going to be super weird if you have like a ruffly carpet and then you have like super clean lines somewhere. So, I mean, having a version or a consistent theme throughout everything and making sure you're willing to look all the way down and all the way up. I think especially when people walk into a restaurant, they're going to stay like looking pretty much eye level, whether they're sitting or standing, and just making sure you're willing to look down, you're willing to look up everywhere you go, and just making sure everything's consistent.
What's your own personal kind of design or aesthetic that you have?
Interior. I tend to like industrial, like pop. I like the idea that from an industrial perspective, I like exposed HVAC. I don't mind exposed pipes. I like something that looks like it's supposed to be there for 100 years. And on the pop version, I like bright colors. I like exaggerated lines. I think those two fusions make me feel the most comfortable.
I think that that makes sense with how Everly looks on an everyday basis.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's from the design, each room, for me, I always want people to feel like they can go in a bar crawl without having to leave the place.
Yeah.
And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing people go to the Cedar Tavern and have a drink before dinner, then go have dinner in the main dining room, and then kind of come back. Like,
yeah.
Literally, they had multiple different experiences without having to move their car.
Yeah. I mean, it's cool. It's one of those restaurants where, or bars, where whatever you're deciding to do there, that you learn something about any time you go back. And even when I was saying that I was interviewing you today, one of the co-hosts of the other podcast of mine, Circling Back, Dylan was like, oh, ask him about this, ask him about this.
Yeah.
And I was like, I didn't even know about that going into
there. There's some weird-ass stories in the place. Like, literally, when I tell people, I'm like, one, the thing of a tour in a restaurant isn't a thing.
Yeah.
We have tours. Like, literally, people know we have tours. And we'll call and put in the reservation notes, can we get a tour of the place?
Yeah.
And that idea is insane.
Yeah.
But, like, the rule of thumb, if it looks old and it looks weird and it looks like it has a story, it probably does.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just crazy. The main mirror in the dining room is from the Cedar Tavern Bar from the 1920s because the first one broke in a fire. The gate that's by the server station is from an old subway in New York. The old office doors are from the 1920s out of Ohio. The light fixtures in the study are from a World War II ship. The original Time magazine where Bob Dylan mentions the Cedar Tavern is posted on the wall. There's just crazy elements that deserve a tour, which is crazy.
Is there do you ever find that it's hard to convey the effort that goes into the restaurant to the everyday customer?
We found it as we've evolved that not everyone cares.
Yeah.
And I think that's super important when it comes to being in hospitality, is not forcing your brand on something or someone. Because what we do is no different than any other restaurant.
Yeah.
What we do on a nightly basis is no different than our competitors. It's super simple. It's what everyone does every day. They eat and they drink.
Yeah.
And for me, that's one of those things I take super personal, because there's over 1,700 registered liquor licenses in the city, and they chose us.
Yeah.
That's a 1 in 1,700 chance.
Yeah.
And then if you want to do it on a bigger scale, let's say someone has their anniversary with us, that happens 1 in 365 days and 1 over 1,700, those odds are literally insane. And that's something that we have to remember on a daily basis. We tell our staff, yeah, you might see 5 anniversaries a night, but they only see 1 anniversary a year, and you need to be able to. You need to make sure that you're taking that serious.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
but not everyone cares that about all these things. Some people just want to enjoy the company they're with. And that's the main element.
I think anyone that takes pride in their work would say that it's probably better that they care more than their customer does.
Yeah.
I would want that out of anyone that I was going to and spending money with. So I think that's probably a good thing.
Totally. No. And again, people go there. Our restaurant's a lot of things for a lot of people. I mean, it could be, you know, a corporate meeting, or it could be a first date, or it could be a last date.
Yeah.
It could be an anniversary or a birthday. It has those fittings. You can get off of Barton Springs at 5 o'clock and go in the Cedar Tavern, have a burger and a beer and shorts and feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Or I always say we're a restaurant that makes old people feel young and young people feel old.
That's actually a very good way of putting it, actually.
Yeah, because if you're young, you're kind of like, oh, wow, I'm fancy.
Kind of swanky.
Yeah, and then when you're a little bit older, you're like, we still got it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically what my parents said. They're like, whew, we feel like we still got it.
That sounds like the perfect combination.
Yeah.
Austin is a very competitive food city. How does a restaurant like Everly maintain its edge on the competition with so many other restaurants that are popping up that are just have been here forever?
The word competitive edge for me is a little bit interesting because I don't want to say that we're trying to edge them out.
Yeah.
But it is. There is a level of competition. You know, you got to fight for the dollars that you make and you earn. Service, hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple.
Yeah.
For me, you can have the world's best meal, but if your service sucks or your server's a dick, you didn't like that meal. You don't want to go back.
Yeah.
But at the same time, let's just say there's something happened. I'll use that as an example where I've been at a restaurant. Maybe the food wasn't great, but the service was outstanding. I'm in. I will be back. Like, I trust that because those practices are in place. So for us, for me, it's like I want to make sure hospitality is huge and it's local hospitality. It's like we live and we work around here. We're not this big hotel. We're a one-off restaurant. And we think of Everly and we think of our work as like our home. It's a personal reflection of us. And we do take it personal if things don't go great or if we mess something up. It sticks in our head, and it's not just mine. It's every staff member. We want to be great because you deserve it. And we know how hard we work for our money, and we want to respect how hard you work for your money. Plenty of places that you could have chose to spend it, and you chose it with us. That's special. And for us and for me, it's always going to be about hospitality. Mm-hmm. And service.
I can really only think of one meal that I've ever had at a restaurant where I had terrible service, but the meal was so good that I'm like, all right, I'll probably go back there.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think it's very true that the way you can differentiate yourself pretty much in any industry is just by, you know, being on the front lines when it comes to customer service and things like that.
Totally.
I think I'd be remiss not talking about this because it's a unique opportunity being in Austin.
Let's do it.
You being the general manager of a large successful restaurant.
Go for it.
Let's talk coronavirus. I normally don't like talking current events on here, but I feel like it's so widespread, the panic, the just narrative as a whole.
Yes.
To the point where they've canceled South by Southwest now.
It's huge.
How has that cancellation affected your restaurant, and how do you think it's going to affect Austin as a whole?
Not much has changed at my restaurant. We're downtown, but we're not downtown. Yes, we had some things going on with South By, but yes, we had some things that were coincidentally between that time frame that had nothing to do with South By.
Yeah.
The whole city is affected, and it's not just food and beverage and hospitality, even though that's a huge focus because that's what South By is. I mean, it's the airport, it's rental cars, it's, you know, influx of servers, it's the people that were coming in from San Antonio to be Uber drivers. It's all that stuff. For me, as a restaurant manager, not that much has changed. We are already a very, very clean restaurant. We have an A health inspection score. We've had to change some small practices. We've had to making sure our staff understands the dialogue and is aware of the circumstances that are in place. For me, it affects our neighbors and people that are more downtown that rely on South By a little bit more. It affects them. And it's financial. That's the thing. And I think that this was supposed to be the biggest South By we've had in like 5 years because it's been dwindling. Attendance has been dwindling. Participants has been dwindling. And I haven't been excited for South By in a long time, except for like this one.
Yeah.
I think it was something we were kind of looking forward to. From a city perspective and a hospitality perspective, I mean, they say it brings in over $350 million a year to the city. And a huge amount of that is food and beverage. Like Adler said, make sure that you go downtown and events are still happening. There are plenty of venues that are not showcase venues that it's going to be business as usual. There's still going to be cool food events. There's still going to be cool live music events. It's kind of like the idea, what I've been hearing that's been circulating around the city between this food and beverage industry. It's like, hey, let's throw some really, really cool events with a minimal amount of money with really cool bands playing. And let's just have some fun, which is kind of the origin of how South By started. It wasn't one of those things that relied on this massive corporate presence. And I think as a city, we can still hold the heart of what made Austin weird and kind of stand behind each other and to the left of each other and the right of each other and in front of each other and making sure that we're protecting ourselves and protecting each other. But it's definitely something that is interesting as far as how the city is handling it and as far as how it affects the community. I think how it affects the community of food and beverage is super important. Yeah. We're seeing people step in. We're seeing what the Roosevelt Room and the Eleanor are doing for local musicians. We're seeing what other venues are. It's like displaced. There's websites, there's donation places. There's, again, the city canceled South By. South By didn't cancel South By.
Yeah.
And I think it's just our responsibility as influencers within the city as to making sure that the dialogue is digestible.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, let's transition to something a little less heavy than coronavirus.
Then
let's do some typical Sunday scaries questions.
Sundays.
You're unique in that you're in the service industry and you get Sundays off.
I get probably 2/3 of them off.
Yes. That's pretty good. That's a pretty good ratio.
It's good. It's good considering we run two services. Sundays. Yeah. It's like the only time I see my wife, which is.
There you go.
It's a bonus. Yeah.
What's your ideal Sunday outfit?
I make it a point not to wear a collared shirt.
Love that.
That's one. Two, I make it a point to wear a hat. Those are like Sunday requirements. Mm-hmm. Everything else is fine. As long as I don't have to wear a collared shirt and I can wear a hat, anything's a go for me.
If I opened your refrigerator right now, what would I find?
It's all full of protein and vegetables. My wife's a PE teacher, so she keeps it pretty clean. And I mean, that's the way I normally cook too. I love cooking.
Yeah.
Which is so funny because in a restaurant, like if you open up a chef's fridge, There's nothing in it.
Yeah, it's empty.
They don't want to cook at home. They don't want to think about it. They just want to, you know, they want to go out and eat or have it brought to them. But if you ask most restaurant managers, they like to cook because they get to see it.
Yeah.
But they don't necessarily get to participate in it. So I like to, you know, I like to try different recipes, but broccoli, snap peas, turkey, chicken, I guess you could say.
I mean, that's more than pretty a lot much of people
the,
have in theirs.
The pyramid, I guess you could say.
Yeah. What are your coping mechanisms? What kind of things relax you?
Being outside, I think, is huge. Restaurant managers don't get breaks. There's not like this hour gap where you have, it's like, oh yeah, I've been at work, you know, for my 4 hours. Let me go take an hour and go walk around the trail.
Yeah.
That does not exist. So I have to find coping mechanisms in like kind of smaller dosages, mm-hmm. Where I'll give myself a break. And it's normally just being outside or making it a point not to talk about the restaurant.
Yeah.
And trying to talk about another subject, in general. I like to be outside and I like to take my dog out and about. I like to go to restaurants that are not, that are a lot more casual, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Right. You don't want to feel like you're at work when you're not at work.
Absolutely.
Do you feel like when you're at a restaurant that you're critiquing them the entire time?
Holy shit. Yeah. Tough. But that's anyone that's a major part of any industry. It's like, let's watch, if you take a professional basketball player and they watch, you know, high school basketball, they're going to, you know, they're going to have their perspective, yeah. On how things should go. It's funny because I'll have to, depending on how my day is, I'll have to pick on where I sit in a place.
Yeah.
Like if I don't want to pay attention, I have to face a wall.
I was going to say, don't sit at the booth.
Yeah. Don't sit at the booth. Like I have to have a very particular perspective. But normally on a Sunday, I like to go to places that have picnic tables and,
I think that makes sense. I think that's a general Sunday vibe for a lot of people.
Yeah. I like breweries and dogs and sound like I'm from Austin now.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
This is the first time I've asked this question to somebody on this podcast. What's on your bedside table?
It's funny you mention it. I have one book and then I have basically a jot book for ideas.
Mm-hmm.
It drives my wife crazy because I randomly come up with, I like to think great ideas. She likes to think not so much, but I like to write them down. And I'm reading the book. I really like to read books about founders, and I'm reading the book about how Starbucks was founded.
Okay.
Yeah.
There you go. I just finished pretty much the Patagonia book from Yvon Chouinard where they talk about that. And the more I thought about it, I was like, I probably should be reading these books.
Dude, the founder books, they're just so, I don't know. I'm not good at storybooks.
Yeah.
Like my wife is forcing me to read all of the Harry Potters and it's just like, I don't like the mystery of the world. I like the realism of like what happened and I guess you could say consequences, whether they're good or bad.
So. I think that makes sense. I always try to dip more into fiction than I think I need to. And then I end up being like, all right, I need to go back to nonfiction just because I don't feel like I'm wasting time, but I don't feel like I'm spending my time as well as I could.
I'm the same way. And I think that would be one of the reasons why I don't relax very well.
Yeah.
Like I'm constantly engaged. So when it comes to coping mechanisms, I need to find a better route. Like I like video games, I guess you could say.
I mean,
video games where I can play for like 30 minutes and I'm good.
That's pretty much exactly how I operate.
Yeah.
I play a quick amount of video games just enough to like make Escape. Me stop thinking about what I was thinking about before.
Same page.
Yep. Do you drink coffee? And if so, how do you take your coffee?
So yes, espresso, dash of cream, dash of hot water. That's it.
Pretty simple.
Yeah.
I'm just glad you drink coffee. I've had too many people on here that don't drink coffee.
Oh no, my favorite story. Okay. I want to tell a story. My favorite story. My favorite thing at Eberle was that one of my very first responsibilities was receiving our espresso machine.
Yeah.
Things like $18,000. That same day we finished the bathrooms, finished the design, finished the install, finished everything. $18,000 espresso machine, beautiful bathrooms, million upon million dollar restaurant. But we still had to go outside to use the porta potty and we had to go to McDonald's to get coffee because we had no running water for the next 3 months. That's one of my favorite stories about the restaurant.
It's just like, you're just
it's the realism.
Like,
you don't have water yet, so none of this matters.
Yep. You just pretty much have like the price of like a really nice used car just sitting there unable to make any coffee.
Essentially speaking, no gas.
Yeah. Seriously. How do you take your eggs?
Whatever the chef is doing, that's the thing. If I have to make it scrambled, if not, whatever you're serving, I'll take.
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
And finally, take me through your ideal Sunday.
Ideal Sunday. I wake up. The first thing I do is not look at my phone on purpose. I make coffee at home. I will read one chapter of a random book or whatever book that I have around. But normally, right after that, I would want to go right into watching football. Obviously, that's not an opportunity right now. Pick out a lunch somewhere. Hopefully, it's a new spot or a new brewery. Play the dog, be home by 5, and do nothing from there.
I think that sounds pretty ideal.
Yeah. Less the better, I guess you could say.
Less is more in the case of most Sundays.
Yes.
Well, Tyler, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
If you liked what you heard today, make sure to subscribe, review, or tell a friend in need about this podcast. By subscribing, you guarantee that each and every episode gets delivered directly to your phone every Sunday morning. You can also follow along on Twitter at SundayScaries and Instagram, which is at Sunday.Scaries, or you can follow me on both Twitter and Instagram at WillDeFreeze. And remember, always trim the wicks on your scented candles. See you next Sunday.